This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio and online Main Street across North Dakota. The Blue Rider is the name of a famous painting by Russian artist Vasily Kandinsky and an abstract movement he helped to found. In North Dakota, the Blue Rider is best known as an iconic bar in downtown Minot. Artist Walter Peel and his wife Becky opened it as the first non-smoking bar in the state. Then the late Fritz Schulder, one of Peel's mentors, painted his own Blue Rider on the wall, which, thanks to Herculean efforts, survived the devastating 2011 flooding of the city. Recently, the bar's ownership changed, and during her visit to Minot, Ashley Thornburg spoke with the new owner, Terry Peterson.
Terry, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for stopping by my bar.
What made you want to buy the Blue Rider?
It was my favorite bar, and it was for sale. You know, I've always had like a side hustle going. This was an interesting one. There's a family connection there, and it was my favorite bar, and I thought if I could make it work, then let's give it a go. That's really where it came from.
Favorite bar. How long you been coming here? What's it like?
I came here the first time in college because it was the only smoke-free bar in North Dakota, and I was going to school at Minot State, so I'd come here to hang out, and then I didn't, moved away. But then I ended up getting a job 16 years ago at a nonprofit 3 blocks up the street, so it became a kind of an after-work venue. Stop for 1, 2, and then head home. So I suppose for the past 15, 16 years, it's been a little more consistent and just popping in, you know, once or twice a week, mm-hmm. meeting the people and knowing the people.
Yeah, what is it about the specifics of this one?
Probably just the full-on acceptance of anybody. Anyone can come in and feel comfortable. It's rare to have that now, I think. Anytime you could have a sanctuary for some of the people who may otherwise not have a place, then I think it's important to keep it that way.
You bought the bar during COVID.
Pretty smart move, right?
Oh, yeah. Great idea.
Yeah, that was a curveball. Walt and I had talked about me purchasing the bar, and for a few months before we actually signed, and I was getting financing together and things like that. We signed in April. I forget when the bars were shut down or mandated to shut down, but it was after we signed and before we closed. So threw a wrench into things, but I guess it is what it is. And I've never done this before, so it's really, I really know no difference, right? So owning a bar during COVID is, that's all I know.
You might keep up the masks and, and stuff, you know, just make it part of the Blue.
Maybe it's a thing.
Just paint a mask onto the Blue right? Rider outside.
Yeah. Under all the cowboys and horses.
You say Walt so casually, but that's Walter Peel to the rest of us, the Walter Peel, a North Dakota icon.
Yeah.
And this was one of his babies.
Growing up, it was always Uncle Walt. My mom's maiden name is Peel. Her dad, so my grandfather, his brother is Walter's dad. So my grandfather, Howard, he had a brother, Walter, whose son is Walter Jr., of course. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were cousins once removed then, Walt and I? Something like that.
Oh, I don't know what
I'm pretty sure
I'm just
going to
believe you. I'm not even going to fact check that one.
I'm pretty sure. So there's that connection as well. And growing up, it wasn't a North Dakota icon. It was Uncle Walt, and he showed up at weddings and, you know, always gifted a painting of some sort. And that was just the way it was for me growing up. So
yeah. Do you remember when you kind of first got a sense that he's famous?
Yeah, 100% actually. I was in seventh grade. We were doing a project where all the students wrote to famous people for autographs. And I thought, well, I'll just write to Walt because I'm sure I'll get something back. And And I didn't. And right?
Well, that's even better.
until like a few months. Yeah, I totally missed that assignment. But a few months later, he showed up and gave me a framed sketch.
No.
He felt really bad because I think the letter got, I don't know. And if you've ever seen a studio, you know, he could have lost that letter, no problem. I remember that. And actually, I held on to that, of course, since 1994. When I bought the bar, I was able to find a spot on this wall for it. So, and it fit right in there. And it's a pretty cool piece. It's like signed, you know, to Cousin Terry and ripped out of a sketchbook. But I think that was about the time where I was like, oh, other people know my relative.
You just referenced this wall and you pointed to an entire wall of art. And we have to start with the obvious one.
Yeah.
So we are sitting in front of a painting called The Blue Rider. And this is a Fritz Scholder. It is actually painted on the walls here. It's under plexiglass. How much do you know about the story of how this painting came to be?
I don't know enough as I should. I know that Fritz was a bit of a mentor to Walt. And I think Walt was impressed with his art and kind of fashioned himself a little bit after Fritz. And they became friends. And after Walt bought the bar, Fritz came in and painted that on the wall. Since Fritz has passed away, and, you know, it's become, I suppose, for this bar in downtown Minot, sort of a bit of a iconic thing. People like to take pictures in front of it and such. But it's a special piece. It's part of the bar, literally, now. So that's pretty cool, too.
Yeah, I mean, technically, you don't own this part of the bar. Okay, you're going to have to explain that to me. This is painted on the wall. You own this building.
Correct.
But you don't own this painting. How does that work?
You'd have to ask the lawyers how that works. I, you know, it's something that I don't think going in, Walt and I will never, you know, we agree on everything, but I think just to keep things cool and all, you know, getting legal language behind everything. Mm-hmm. He wanted to make sure that he held on to the ownership of the Fritz, which completely understand. Also, him owning that section of the wall probably allowed me to buy the building.
Because, probably knocked the price down a little chunk there.
Yeah, it was a win-win.
Are you going to tell me what this painting is worth?
I couldn't tell you. I'm not a art appraiser.
Okay, can you tell me what the building would have cost with the painting and what it did cost?
I can tell you that I could not have gotten financing for this building had I owned that section of wall.
Okay. So Walter Peel owns this section of the wall?
Yes. If he were so inclined, he could come cut that piece of wall out.
Fascinating. If that happens, will you call me? I want to be here for that.
Okay. I hope it never comes to that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it seems like it won't, but I've never heard of that. Like, whatever they said, he just owns, what, a quarter inch deep into the drywall?
Yeah, and half, I believe half it says in half. The
language. Very
specific.
Language. Okay.
I got through a couple pages of the lawyer stuff, and I was like, I think this looks good. I'll sign it.
Wow. What do you think of that painting?
It's great. I think it fits the bar perfectly. I mean, we're here at the Blue Rider. It's a Blue Rider, so.
Yeah.
I love it.
What does it mean?
I don't know. What, Blue Rider? Or just the painting?
The name, the painting.
The name?
Yeah.
I don't think there's any mistakes in art. You can interpret it however you want.
Hmm.
The namesake, though, of the Blue Rider came from 20th century Impressionist movement, German Impressionist movement, Der Blau writers. So that's where another inspiration of Walt's from back in the day was that interpretive movement.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of where the name came from. And then, of course, I think Fritz drew inspiration on that. for the painting.
Well, also on the wall, I'm seeing Arvin Davis. He owns the Little Red Liar studio in town. I know that Sean Ann Tangney, who is heavily involved with the Goodnight Live show, her shoes are hanging on the wall. There is a box on the wall with a man's ashes. He was a local musician. So this wall, it kind of belongs to Minot, doesn't it?
It's always going to be local artists, local stories, originals when we can. Some things move every once in a while, but it needs to be a special piece to make it. Had this wall not been included in the sale, I don't think I would have bought the rider, because it's an essential piece of what the rider is.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to keep the rider the rider. And without this wall, it isn't.
So it is an icon, of course, but it's also yours now. Are you also trying to make it Terry Peterson's bar?
Man, maybe accidentally.
Hmm.
There were some things that needed to change when I purchased the bar. A lot of those were systems related. Installing a walk-in, the tap system, versus using bottles mainly. The bar itself needed to change a bit. So the back wall of the bar needed to change. Some refrigeration changes. Again, addition of a POS.
Is that a purchase operating system, or what's a POS?
Point of sale.
Thank you.
Yeah, up until I purchased the bar, it was cash only. Having that POS,
Who even uses cash anymore?
Right. Well, if you came here, you.
You did. Okay.
But now, you can take card and having that inventory accountability behind that system. I mean, these are all things in place changes that needed to be in place, I think, just from a business, more of a business standpoint.
Yeah, that's logistics.
Yeah,
let's talk personality here.
Yeah, well, some of those came with the need to change the aesthetics, and I tried to take as much care as I could with if I needed to change something in the bar that I did it, true to what the rider was.
Mm.
The back wall art piece is actually an original from the 20s of a gallery showing from Dublau writers. I think it was a German museum that the showing was at. So, certain things when I saw it, I was like, that fits, right? So I'd pick up something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I really tried to keep it pretty much the same. There may be more Star Wars in here.
I was going to say, I think the Star Wars might be a newer element here.
Well, technically speaking, that's also a function of just the system changes. The cabinets above the back wall bar used to be just full of cans and bottles, right? They had hundreds of different bottle selections.
Mm.
So when I moved to more keg and tap focused, I had a bunch of empty cabinets to fill.
Uh-huh.
So I reached for the...
I got this.
Yeah. So I reached for the Star Wars stuff because that's what I had. And I thought it was, at least quirky enough and... Mm-hmm. It'd work here. So, and then the Han Solo piece actually is an original, an artist downtown here, Eric Hansen, came in here one day and saw the Star Wars figures, vintage Star Wars figures in the cabinet, and said, "I've got a piece for you," and so he brought that over actually the next day.
What is it about Star Wars?
Oh man, I don't know. Good question. I've always just been into sci-fi, I guess, and. The collecting piece kind of came later, but as a kid that was into collecting baseball cards and things like that, now maybe collecting some vintage Star Wars stuff, it just kind of fit with me. And so, yeah, instead of sitting in a box somewhere, now they're at least on display.
How much more is there to bartending than meets the eye?
Oh, here?
Yeah.
The actual function, what you're doing to get that product to the customer is pretty simple. What people forget is that, anyone can go to an off-sale place and get a beer and go home and drink it for one-fifth the price, at a bar. So what are we actually selling here? And your bartenders become that point of socialness that people are wanting, right? They're the, along with other customers, they're sort of the directors of that social commodity that you're selling, because we're not selling beer. We're selling more of that X factor, that intangible, that social aspect. So again, with COVID, it's made that difficult with reduced capacity and missing some people because they don't want to go out. So getting creative in like including as many people as possible and really pushing bartenders to just interact. That's like the side that people don't see. That is so important.
Yeah, you're part best friend, you're part counselor sometimes.
Oh, yeah. And if you don't want to be, you have to be, because that's part of it.
Yeah. You said reduced capacity, and already I'm thinking there can't be more than 40 people that would fit in here. That seems pretty tight to me. What's the non-COVID max capacity?
Well, we have inside 30, outside 20. Okay. So we're at a little more than that, actually. 52 is like total capacity. But when you're looking inside, we used to have at least 4 tables along this wall. So I've taken that out. You're right, 40 people in here would be pretty jimmied, right? So we try to limit it to 20 right now, which hasn't been a problem.
A lot of people aren't wanting to go
right
out.
So yeah. And I don't want to put people in a position where they don't feel safe. Blue Rider was the first bar in North Dakota who went smoke free because of
ahead.
Yeah, way back, right? Health and safety concerns. And now we have another health and safety concern with the COVID and the masks. And so we were the first ones to mandate masks, not just for employees, but for customers as well, here in Minot. We also have the plexi up for the bartenders because their safety is, number one. I wouldn't want to make someone work in an environment that I wouldn't feel safe working at. I think we're there right now, and I think it's probably going to, we're probably going to have to put more things in place. But yeah, I think the mask mandate thing was again true to what the rider has stood for.
Financially, are you doing okay? COVID's a weird time. I mean, they always say that vice is recession proof, and you could make some arguments that alcohol can be a vice.
Right. I made the mortgage payment. That being said, being dead honest with you, I've never done this before. I think we're okay. My CPA, we have meetings, and he's pretty okay. Chill. So
yeah,
as long as he's not calling me with some urgent thing, I think we're okay. It has been tougher the last month, especially, but
because you're going into that no patio season.
Yep, the patio is a big draw here, and when you're looking at that being 80% of your capacity, the winter is going to be interesting.
Do you feel like the state is doing a good job taking care of small businesses, local businesses?
I don't know. Again, this is my first kind of foray into it, so I have no idea what they did before. I think that there was some problems with the ERG grant rollout. Those monies were allocated more towards maybe not small business, or maybe the smaller businesses didn't quite get the help they needed in application for that. I'm always watching for the reallocation of the CARES dollars and seeing what we can maybe go for. But they're in a tough spot too. This is unprecedented, and I think there's people there with the best intentions. I hope that it can get down to the smaller businesses more. But again, I've never owned a business before, so this is new.
Yeah, new to you and in an unprecedented time, so this is probably an unfair question, but what's next?
I don't know. I enjoy the bar. I enjoy this as a side hustle. I think it is important to keep the rider here and solvent and open, and I'm going to do my best to see that through, especially through the COVID thing. My hope is that once things go back to normal, if they do, then I can step away a little more. But right now, it's my responsibility to maybe keep the doors open and the lights on And so I'm going to work hard to make that a reality.
Terry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for stopping in.
Main Street's Ashley Thornburg talking with the owner of Minot's well-known Blue Rider Bar, Terry Peterson. Next on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. Basin Electric Power Cooperative, striving to be your trusted energy partner.
Every election has consequences. Hi, I'm Dave Thompson. If you haven't yet done your duty, please vote. Then listen on election night, Tuesday, November 3rd, beginning at 6 p.m. Central, as NPR brings you results as they come in from contests around the country, and of course, what many are saying is the most important presidential election of our lifetime. I'll chime in with regional results, including from the hotly contested race for North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction and Minnesota's 7th Congressional District. Prairie Public and NPR will be able to bring this historic moment into focus. So listen to a reassuring presence on a night of high drama and in the days beyond. Tuesday, November 3rd, beginning at 6 Central, 5 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Natural North Dakota is the name of the essays Chuck Lura creates for Prairie Public. They draw on his experience as a naturalist and college biology teacher, and they feature interesting insights into the nature around us. Today, Chuck's subjects are a snake and a bird.
I've had a couple of interesting sightings recently, a red-bellied snake and some immature Harris's sparrows. I recently managed a good look at a red-bellied snake. They're one of our smaller snakes, growing to perhaps 8 to 10 inches long. This one was gray, but they can also be various shades of brown to gray. They have a stripe down the center of their back and sides that may be rather inconspicuous, as well as some pale spots on the neck. But the conspicuous characteristic is the red belly, which can also vary a bit in color. We have no similar species, so identification is quite easy. Red-bellied snakes are documented in North Dakota north and east of the Missouri River, roughly from Ransom and Sargent counties westward to Logan and McIntosh, then northwestward to McLean, McHenry, and Bottineau counties. They're often observed around moist wooded areas, such as along rivers and streams, and other areas where they feed mainly on earthworms, snails, and slugs. Seeing a red-bellied snake was a treat. Plus, we've recently had some rather unusual sparrows in our yard feeding on the ground as well as in platform feeders with sunflower seeds. After checking my bird guides, I was able to identify them as immature Harris's sparrows. The Harris's sparrow is a large sparrow, probably our largest. The adults are easily identified by their pink bill and showy black bib, face, and crown. They're quite impressive. Their breeding grounds are north in the tundra, and they winter in the southern Great Plains, roughly from Nebraska southward. So they pass through North Dakota during the spring and fall migrations. I commonly see the adults during migration, but apparently I hadn't noticed the juveniles. Rather than sporting the showy black bib, face, and crown, the juveniles have a brownish face, white chin and throat, with black spots below and streaks on the sides of the breast. These characteristics, particularly the white throat and black spots below, were very helpful in identification. The red-bellied snakes are probably getting ready to hibernate, and the Harris's sparrows are probably heading south for the winter. They'll be out of sight soon, so as you travel about, be on the lookout for these interesting animals. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll get a preview of this week's Great American Folk Show, and we'll talk about Halloween on Main Street Eats. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's COVID-19 death toll is now 499 after 11 more individuals have passed away with the disease. The patients were from Cass, Dickey, Emmons, Logan, Stutzman, McLean, Oliver, Ransom, and Ward counties. They ranged in age from their 50s all the way to their 90s. Additionally, 1,222 new individuals from 49 counties have also tested positive for the novel coronavirus. 6,771 cases are currently active, while 41,130 individuals have contracted the virus overall. Today's results are from a pool of 8,402 tests for a daily positive rate of 15.62%. 278 new cases were found in Cass County, 169 in Burley County, 165 in Ward County, and 97 in Grand Forks County. Morton County had 60 new cases, Stutsman County had 48, and Walsh County had 44. McLean, Mercer, Ramsey, Rillette, Ransom, Barnes, and Richland counties all had 20 or more new cases. According to the State Health Department's coronavirus dashboard, 184 people are listed as hospitalized due to COVID-19. The dashboard says 550 people have recovered since yesterday. The head of the NDUS Smart Restart Task Force says challenges remain as faculty and staff work to keep college campuses open. Dr. Joshua Wynn says the start of the fall semester, there was a substantial number of cases among students. Wynn says in recent weeks, the trend lines are following what's going on in the community.
We did have an increase in cases, likely, due to students returning to campus from their local communities, but now there is community spread going on due to small gatherings. Typically, we would say off campus, that then those cases are then discovered on campus.
Wynn says the keys to controlling the pandemic within the university system include more robust contact tracing and enhanced testing. NDOS Chancellor Mark Hagerod says one of the most important things moving forward is finding ways to keep students on campus to have that human connection. And President Trump's Phase 1 trade agreement with China isn't meeting its targets, according to trade experts. Here's Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin.
The agreement signed in January was ambitious to begin with, but the most recent data show that by the end of September, China had only bought about half as much as what was targeted. Chad Bown is a trade expert with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says it's very unlikely that China will ultimately meet its purchasing goals.
They would have to buy a lot of aircraft in the last 3 months of 2020, you know, big ticket items like that. They would have to buy a lot of soybeans.
Bound says there are many reasons China's falling short, including the grounding of some Boeing planes, animal disease outbreaks, and the COVID-19 pandemic. He says it remains to be seen whether this will impact President Trump's reelection chances. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
And for Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The Great American Folk Show airs its new show this Sunday on Prairie Public's radio service. Hosted by North Dakota singer-songwriter Tom Brousseau, the seventh episode will include songs and stories and, as usual, more. Ashley Thornburg talked to Tom about what's coming up.
Tom, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me back on Main Street.
So I'm going to start with kind of a nerd moment for me because frankly, less on the music side, more on the TV side. You have a beloved recurring character from the Gilmore Girls on this episode. It's possible I've watched that entire series more than once. Grant Lee Phillips.
The town troubadour.
Yeah.
Yeah. Grant Lee, you know, he's just an all-around really wonderful performer. And a lot of people know him because of that TV show, The Gilmore Girls, or Gilmore Girls. I always want to put a "the" in front of Gilmore Girls. And yet, you know, he's had this really enduring career in music. But apparently when he was growing up in California, he was very theatrical and was into comedy. And so in a way, music kind of gave him this opportunity to be a part of this really special TV show, Gilmore Girls. You say that you know the episodes pretty well?
Oh, yeah. I've seen that show a couple times. And, you know, he is in good musical company there, too. They had Sebastian Bach on from Skid Row. And Carole King doesn't just do their lead song, but she is also a recurring guest character in the show, the Carole King. So, and probably some other ones in there too, but there's a nice musical tradition in that show.
I just love that show. I really do. And I love Grant Lee Phillips's character kind of is an interlude almost on the program. He's walking around and singing a song. He's got his microphone stuck in between a harmonica holder, you know?
Yeah. Does he do that? Is he a troubadour?
Yeah, he is. In the sense that, you know, he is not too particular about where he plays. He's one of these people, I think, you know, once you get into music, you just love to play and you want to play. That's kind of the drive. And I would say Grant Lee Phillips is very much that person. And I think what makes him even more, you know, especially linked to the troubadour is that he's got this really beautiful voice, let's face it, and he often sings about love. And I think that's what the troubadours are all about.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of your role on the show, too, that person who ties all of the threads together.
Sometimes it's not that easy, I got to tell you.
No. I would venture to say it's almost never easy, but, you know, it depends on what people give you. Such an impressive young woman on episode 7, Sophia Wolfson. What is she, maybe 20 years old?
Yeah, I think you're right. She can't be older. Let's just put it this way. She's probably not older than 23.
Yeah.
And, yeah, as you mentioned, impressive. And, you know, she has this voice. It's akin to so many great voices that have come into the realm of singer-songwriter and folk music and country. I mean, I immediately think of young Joni Mitchell. Her control and how she uses her voice, but then she's got the songwriting skills and the guitar playing skills to back it all up. And that's a fun thing. You know, not always does a performer have all of those skills in one bag. You know, they might have the singing down, but maybe not the playing so much. But in this case, Sophia Wolfson really does have it all.
Yeah, that was so fun to hear.
Throughout
the course of the 7 seasons that have been released so far, you have not shied away from talking about race. And this is, of course, a very significant time in American history in talking about race relations. And in particular, there is a musician, Troy Burt, and he is talking about folk music. And he addresses right away that you think folk music, you know, that's Lily McWhiteface kind of music, but actually talks about the history.
It's kind of, in a way, you know, Trey Burt is talking about the tradition of folk music and of blues. And then, yet, in another sense, it's a tradition to steal and to kind of take that and, I suppose, to monetize on it. I mean, if you're going to get into music, you know, you have to figure out how you're going to make your living. And so Trey Burt, his particular monologue is really interesting because it does highlight all of these sort of these facets of folk music and blues music, that one is, you know, a genre for African Americans and then the other is a genre for whites. I'm talking about folk music.
Yeah.
But the thing is it belongs to everybody. I just think that there are some people out there who've kind of made money off of it and maybe not given the credit where the credit was due.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that does happen.
You know, I think of other performers too, like Tom Waits, for example. I mean, he's kind of a sort of a blend. He's a mixture of so many different people. Of not just African-American males, but African-American females, of people that were nowhere near his heritage. You know, I think this is important, though. I think that we need to highlight these voices and these, you know, this art that has come before us. I was thinking, you know, earlier today about a Bob Dylan record that I love, maybe one of the first that I ever bought, called World Gone Wrong. And he's playing folk songs, nothing that he wrote. And, you know, buying that record and listening to that title track on that record, World Gone Wrong, it was enlightening because I found out he doesn't write all of his material. He covers other people's songs. and you're given this opportunity to go back to the source because of Bob Dylan or because of Elvis Presley or, you know, because of Tom Waits, and realize the web that is there, the web of folk music, the web of country blues, the web of vaudeville. It's really quite something.
Yeah, creativity doesn't exactly exist in a vacuum, if you will.
No, it doesn't. No, the whole point is you have to kind of start out acting like somebody that you're not. You have to figure out what your influences are, and you kind of got to just, almost like you have to eat them. You have to make them a part of who you are. You have to emulate that. And then, you know, I think through that process, you kind of become your own thing.
What was that process like for you?
Well, I had this magnificent record collection that belonged to my grandfather, Dean Brusso. And I had all the time in the world to listen to some of these people that we talked about. And also local people like Luther Bjerke. We had his records growing up, and I listened to his records. And the Ink Spots and the Mills Brothers and Al Jolson and Nat King Cole, all of these records, in some way, if I could have taken them to bed with me and slept with them, I probably did, you know, because they were that dear. You know, when something just, when it touches you, you don't want to let it go. And, you know, when you get into the arts, you kind of never do let it go. It just becomes a part of you.
Tom, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me on again, Ashley. I really appreciate it.
Tom Brusseau, host of The Great American Folk Show, talking with our Ashley Thornburg. The show airs this Sunday at 5 Central. Main Street Eats is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
What's it like to live in the woods alone, not speaking to a single soul for 30 years? Or wander the desert, uncover a hidden well, and dive to the bottom of the deepest hole for over 2,000 miles. Hey, North Dakota, I'm Glenn Washington. Experience amazing stories from the people who live them on Snap Judgment. Join me every Saturday in Prairie Public for Snap. Snap Judgment airs Saturday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 p.m. Mountain on Prairie Public.
Then at 6 p.m. Central, it's Livewire with me, your host, Luke Burbank. Each week on our show, we talk to all kinds of folks, writers, actors, artists, comedians. Plus, we've got live music, and we even like to hear from you. Yes, you, the Prairie Public listener. You're going to have your chance to chime in as well. It's all the fun of a live event. Remember those? Those were awesome. All from the safety and comfort of your radio. Don't miss Livewire, Saturday nights at 6 Central, following Snap Judgment on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and it's time for Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom.
We check in with Sue once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What are you going to be for Halloween?
Have you seen my face?
Yes,
what's the problem?
I'm always wearing a mask.
Oh, well, aren't we all?
Yeah. Right. Think about that. You know, like, I remember somebody saying, somebody said something to me once about, golly, when I was working as an artist full time, it was like, I wish I could dress like you. And I'm like, you just get up in the morning, you say to yourself, what am I going to be today? And then you dress appropriately. So I'm costuming almost every day of my life. And as I get older, I'm leaving the house less, and so I have to costume less. But once in a while, it's kind of fun to dress funky and get out in public. Although, I think it's going to be kind of cold for Halloween, and so maybe we won't see any goblins out there.
Well, we'll also have the concern about people going door to door during a pandemic. So I think that's cooling some people's jets as well.
Yeah, and it's sad too because Halloween's on a Saturday, and I'm sure there would be a lot of like costume contests at bars and stuff that they probably won't be able to have. So let's have our own Halloween fun, okay?
Okay.
First of all, Halloween is here because on November 1st is All Saints Day, and Halloween is the hallowed eve before All Saints Day, and we're all saints, you know. At least at my house, we are. And Halloween started with Samhain, which is a Gaelic festival at the end of year. And it's kind of a celebration of the harvest. And we were lucky enough to get like enormous, beautiful pumpkins this year. And I love pumpkin. I love carving pumpkins. And pumpkins have been known to, you know, like, cure snake bites. These people thought
they were known for that.
Well, yeah, at one time they thought that was a cure for snake bite was pumpkin. And we have grown pumpkins in North America for nearly 5,000 years. When I say we, I use that term loosely because Columbus and his buddies or whoever came over here first, Magellan or somebody like that, pumpkins were introduced to them by the Native Americans. They didn't grow pumpkins until they came to the Americas. And they are kind of crossbreed with each other. Like if you plant a bunch of varieties of pumpkins, you get like mutated pumpkins, which might, you know, add to the legend of Sleepy Hollow and things like that at Halloween. They're kind of fun. You cannot save their seeds if they cross-pollinate. Like that. They are cucurbit. And so they are good for you too because they're orange. You know, anything orange is good for your eyes. You know, squash and pumpkins, and you can use them interchangeably. And carving pumpkins, of course, like, oh, when we carved them, we just cut the tops off of them and make triangles for eyes and stick a candle in there. But, you know, there's a lot of people now that are doing really funky carvings on pumpkins.
Oh, I used to really entertain my kids because I would carve the pumpkins with a drill. And I would make caricature faces in them. Yeah, because you can make smaller holes and you can actually do detail.
Wow.
And you can get through the shell like that.
Pumpkins are a food we play with, you know.
So, right. And what's not fun about grabbing their guts and slimy and, you know, and of course you got to save the seeds. You can make necklaces out of them or you can roast them and eat them, of course. But the jack-o'-lantern, and I did not know this until just doing a little research recently, the jack-o'-lantern name came from a story about Stingy Jack. And Stingy Jack was a blacksmith, and he played a lot of tricks on people. And so he was said to have tricked the devil himself over and over and over again. Now, I don't know wherever he met up with the devil. I've never met him face to face. But according to this story, he convinced the devil to climb a tree because there was fruit in the tree. And so while the devil was up there, Jack trapped him in the branches by either carving a cross in the bark or laying multiple crosses around the tree. And so then he's negotiating with the devil and he promises that he can go free as long as the devil doesn't take his soul to hell when he dies. So when Jack eventually dies, he lets the devil go. He eventually dies. He arrives at the gates of heaven, but is denied entrance. Hmm. So he visits hell and he's like, what's up, man? I made this deal with you and I can't get into heaven. And then the devil's like, well, you know, you can't get into hell either. Surprise! And so he's trapped between heaven and hell with no place for his soul to settle. Because the devil does have a kind little kindness in his heart, he gives him an ember to light his way. And Jack puts that in a hollowed out radish, of course, which he uses for a lamp. Because they didn't have pumpkins when they wrote this story, apparently. But that's Jack's old lantern. And so they used to, seriously, carve turnips instead of turnips and radishes instead of pumpkins.
Wow,
but that's
that.
Why they call it a jack-o'-lantern. I did not know that either before, but that was kind of cute.
Let's talk about size matters with pumpkins here, because I'm sure if you're making a pie or something like that, there's an optimum size for that pumpkin. And if you're you know, taking part in the Stillwater annual giant pumpkin thing where they've got pumpkins that weigh over 1,000 pounds, those may not be the best pie pumpkins. I don't know.
That is correct, Doug. You grow Howden pumpkins if you want great, big, beautiful, wide-ridged pumpkins for jack-o'-lanterns. And if you're going to grow pumpkins for pie, you will want a sugar pumpkin or a peanut pumpkin. There's different varieties that actually make better pie. And I personally use Blue Hubbard squash when I make pumpkin pie from scratch, because that has got a deep, rich flavor. And no one will ever know unless you tell them that you didn't use a pumpkin in your pumpkin pie, which is another one of those things which I love, a good pumpkin pie.
I used to until I ate an entire one on Christmas Eve.
And I've
been off
didn't.
Pumpkin pie now for decades.
Yeah. With or without whipped cream?
I think it was naked. Yeah, I think it was just pumpkin pie and too much of it.
Do you know what a blagenda is?
No.
Oh, my gosh. My mother, back in the day, my mom used to make blagenda, which are basically a pumpkin hand pie. But the gals back in the old German-Russian country, instead of using canned, mushed-up pumpkin, they would scrape pumpkin from the inside.
Oh,
you know, you
gosh.
Take the seeds out, and they would scrape that pumpkin or grate it. And then you mix it with sugar and cinnamon, and you put it in like a pie crust or a soft, sweet dough crust and bake this little in German country, we're talking 10 inches long and about 4 inches wide. And those are so good, but they actually made them with onion also. And then you ate them with bean soup. And then that was kind of like a traditional meal back in the day.
So that sounds good,
yes.
Actually.
Oh God, I'll tell you, I haven't had a good blagenda in forever, which I might have to add that to my list of things to do this weekend.
Oh, I'm sure
you
have
know, if I can't go trick-or-treating. Okay, so now the grand finale of Halloween this year. And this is something that just makes me so excited.
Me
is
too.
That we are having the second full moon of the month. And if you've been like an observer of the skies, right up there to the east in the morning, almost the whole month of October has been Mars. And it is actually so close to Earth right now that it looks red. I've never seen it look as red as it has this year. And it's the second full moon, which is called a blue moon, on Halloween. So can you imagine what's going to happen that night? It's going to be so
exciting. During
a pandemic,
I can't.
During a pandemic. We're all going to be watching
too many
movies
things.
On Netflix. So
I think everybody could just be a plague doctor for Halloween. Like, just wear a plague mask. Like at,
there we go. We get right.
Everybody
on.
Be
all
a
wearing
corpse
masks,
robber.
Aren't we? but this blue moon will only happen again. Like it only happens like 18 or 19 years that a blue moon lands on Halloween. So
nice.
Get some popcorn balls, carve some pumpkins, find a good movie, and enjoy your happy Halloween blue moon holiday.
We will. Thanks, Sue.
Thank you, guys.
We check in with Sue Belcom every week. Always a pleasure. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Next time on The Pulse, think about all of the details that are stored in your brain.
My name is
Kevin Berth.
And I can remember.
The Latin name is Schmittea Mediterranea.
Where does all of that information live?
Yeah, so this is a search that has gone on for probably about 7 or 8 decades.
How memory works.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 29th. Voting in the November general election was a real concern among North Dakota residents during the 1918 flu pandemic. Authorities estimated the state had 15,000 active cases on this date, which was the deadline for voter registration. One town in southwestern North Dakota reportedly had half of its 100 residents sick with the flu or had already died from it. There was talk of postponing the general election. The pandemic had already closed schools, churches, and other places of public gatherings. It was a major election for North Dakota, coming when the Populist Nonpartisan League was in control. 10 constitutional amendments were on the ballot, along with North Dakota's congressional seats and statewide offices. Governor, state superintendent, and a seat on North Dakota's Supreme Court were the hottest races. The flu was seen as a barrier for the election. Expectations were for a turnout of 100,000 voters, about 20,000 less than 1916. The results weren't readily accepted by everyone. In Sargent County, two House candidates were sick at home at the time of the vote, but that wasn't the problem. The race became controversial when the election board in the town of Foreman counted ballots behind locked doors, acting on public health guidance to keep crowds away. The League-controlled House threw out the 125 Foreman votes and seated the Leaguer incumbent, who would have been beaten by an independent. Foreman voters were outraged. They said the House had disenfranchised them. Attorney General Bill Langer even went to Foreman the following spring to investigate, but found no evidence of election fraud. Two Leaguer candidates for Stark County House seats challenged the ballots of six Belfield voters who, while sick with the flu, cast their votes from home. The House threw out the votes, but that didn't change the outcome of the election. The flu also sickened state officials, such as the Speaker of the House, the Attorney General, and the outgoing and incoming lieutenant governors. But the risk of flu didn't keep crowds away from Governor Lynn Frazier's inaugural address at the opening of the legislature, which coincided with former President Theodore Roosevelt's death from an embolism. The House Chambers Gallery was packed to the limit of its standing room, while chairs for spectators occupied every available inch of space on the floor. Not the best setting for social distancing. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Jack Dura. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after the show, you can find any Main Street as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Tomorrow on our show, we'll continue Minot Week as our Journalist Roundtable features guests Joe Skrzeszewski, news director and anchor at KMOT, and senior reporter Jill Schramm with the Minot Daily News. Then our Friday film reviewer, Matt Olin, will talk about the North Dakota Film Society's poll of favorite movies. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.